Shall we go into the third Dalai Lama's text? Okay. So last week we were talking about the qualities of a spiritual master, and we went through the 10 qualities that we look for in a Mahayana teacher. And we were saying that before we choose somebody as our teacher, that's the time to do this kind of investigation and observation to see if they have these qualities. And then we were also saying it can be difficult to find somebody with all 10. So if you can't find with 10, then with 9 or with 8 or with, you know, whatever. And then, you know, most important is that the person cares more about future lives than this life, cares more about others than themselves, and has some respect or feeling that things do not exist the way they appear. Now, the qualities of a disciple. So the third Dalai Lama says, the disciple should have 3 fundamental qualities. 1, sincerity. 2, intelligence, able to discriminate between beneficial and misleading forces on the path. 3, intense longing to gain spiritual understanding and experience. As well, he or she should have a 4th quality, appreciation for the Dharma and the teacher. So let's start just by looking at these. So sincerity, and when we're looking at these qualities, these are qualities that we want to try and develop in ourselves. Yeah. So it's not like we look at ourselves and say, well, I don't have that one, I don't have that one, I don't have that one, so give up. You know, but it's like, okay, that one could use some improving. So how can I improve this quality? Because the more we can make ourselves into better disciples, then the more we're going to benefit from having contact with teachers. Okay? So sincerity is the first one. So, you know, somebody has a genuine interest in the Dharma. They're sincere. They're coming, you know, we want to have a sincere motivation for practice. You know, it's not because we want to sit in the front rows, and it's not because we want to be the tea shop guru. It's not because we want to look like a holy person, you know, to somebody else. It's not because we want to impress somebody else with our spiritual knowledge. It's not because we want to, hang around somebody who's holy and kind of squeeze all of their goodness out of them, hoping that we'll catch some of it. You know, some people really, they're like leeches on the teachers, kind of, you know. Let's pull this energy out of them, maybe I'll get some of it. Okay? But rather, you know, having a sincere wish to learn and practice and attain the Dharma goals. Then the second is intelligence, able to discriminate between beneficial and misleading forces on the path. Okay. So intelligence is very important on the path. And this, it doesn't mean the intelligence like that they measure by IQ tests. It's not like that. But it's the intelligence that can discern and examine and analyze and probe the teachings. Okay? So that you don't just listen and say, oh yeah, I believe that, or oh yeah, that makes sense. But you really want to probe it and investigate it. Okay? The term that is sometimes translated as intelligence is also translated as wisdom or as knowledge. Okay, it's the word sherab. S-H-E-R-A-B. You know, so we want to have this ability, you know, when we hear teachings, to really think about them. Yeah? Now, actually, you know, they talk about two quali- two two types of disciples. One is the kind of the person who follows on faith, and then the other one is the person who's said to be of higher faculties, who follows based on wisdom. Okay. So the person who follows on faith, they'll hear a Dharma teaching and they'll say, oh, that, you know, or they'll read a text. Oh, that text was written by Maitreya, so it must be true. And they won't do a lot of analysis. Or that teaching was given by my teacher who I have a lot of respect for, so it must be true. So because of faith in the person who gave the teaching, then they have faith in the teaching itself. Now, that's good. There's nothing wrong with that. Okay? But what would be good is if, you know, we added a little bit more wisdom or discernment or intelligence to it. So it's not just a thing of, you know, oh, I have faith, I believe that, because, you know, that faith is good. You are open to the teachings, but you don't necessarily understand the teachings very well because you haven't probed and investigated. Okay? So the person of high faculties is one who really thinks. Now, well, why did they say that? You know, my teacher said this, or Maitreya said this, or Tsongkhapa said this. What? Why did they say this? Why didn't they say that? What in the world do they mean by these words? How does this compare here and compare to there? How does that apply to me? You know, and so that person's really investigated. So that's said to be somebody of high faculties. Okay, so that person is one that has this kind of intelligence. Here, they're talking about the intelligence specifically, yeah? The intelligence to discern what to practice and what to abandon. Yeah? So you hear lots of teachings, and, you know, what do I practice and what do I abandon on the path? So it doesn't mean, I practice this practice now and another practice later. It's not that kind of what do I practice, but it's in looking at your own mind. What do you practice in your own mind and what do you abandon in your own mind? What qualities do you want to enhance and how do you go about doing that? And what qualities in your own mind do you want to abandon and how do you go about doing that? Okay? And then the third is an intense longing to gain spiritual understanding and experience. So, you know, this person, again, I mean, they have this intense longing. So the Dharma is really important to them. It's not just a hobby. It's not just sometimes something that they do on occasion when they have a little bit of extra time. It's not something that they skip over when they're tired or when they're busy, you know, with their social life. But instead they really have, you know, a sincere disciple, and this kind we want to be, has a real sincere longing for spiritual understanding and the purification and the wisdom that comes from that. Okay? So that gets developed, I think, by meditating on death, meditating, you know, I mean, all the long-term topics, basically, they kind of wake us up to, you know, what is our potential and are we using it properly? Okay, so to really have that attitude where our spiritual practice is the foremost thing in our life. And the more we have that, then the easier practice becomes. Because the more important Dharma is to us, then Dharma practice becomes easier because your mind automatically wants to do it, you know? And then if you take precepts and you have to skip breakfast and skip dinner, it's not a problem because you want to do that. Or if you have to, you know, like people, you come to the Abbey, you give up a certain degree of your own individual freedom coming to live in community. You know, there's a daily schedule. You've got to follow the daily schedule. And there's rotas for cooking and cleaning and, you know, doing certain things. And there's all these things that you do. So you give up some of the freedom that you have. But you're willing to do that because you want another kind of freedom. Yeah? And that's the freedom that comes when you follow your spiritual yearning. You're able to learn the teachings and practice them and look at your own mind. Okay? And so giving up the things that you need to give up to come and live at the Abbey is not a big deal, because your spiritual longing is what's important in your life. Yeah? But if that's not important, then the idea, you know, of living at the Abbey and, oh, I can't just go to town when I feel like getting some cookies, and I can't go out and buy a latte when I want to, and I have to be at meditation at, you know, whatever hour it is every morning, and I have to eat at these times, I can't just, you know, eat whenever I want to, you know, then those things become incredibly big deals, you know. And a person can go, oh, yeah, oh, I can't stand it, it's too confining, you know. Well, that's because they lack that genuine, you know, spiritual yearning. Because when you have that spiritual yearning, these other things are not such a big deal to you. Okay? So we see this a lot, this, you know, don't we? Okay, and then the fourth quality is appreciation for the Dharma and the teacher. And so clearly, I mean, if you're going to invest your time in learning and studying the Dharma, in being a good disciple, you have to, you know, have respect for the Dharma and the teacher. Otherwise, you know, you're not going to have any interest in even being around. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Because you have more respect for the movie stars and more respect for the sports heroes. Okay? So you want to look at the basketball game or the fashion show or whatever it is. But, you know, when you cultivate the attitude of respect for the Dharma and respect for the teacher, you know, then again that really inspires you to learn and to practice. And, you know, lots of times in the long run when they talk about relating to the teacher and what a powerful object of karma our spiritual teachers are, for either creating good karma or for creating bad karma. Sometimes we get this feeling of, well, you know, they emphasize respecting the teacher so much, you know, well, that's just because it was taught by a teacher and they want somebody to respect them. You know? You know, kind of setting it all up for themselves so that, you know, they receive some respect and honor and offering. But if you really do the meditation, you know, then you see that when we respect our teachers, we're the ones who benefit from it. Okay? You know, now, with a very superficial mind, we might think, well, our teacher benefits by having these disciples that respect them. Well, how does our teacher benefit? You know, maybe they get some cookies or they get some apples or, you know, they get gazillions of emails to answer, you know? So, you know, you get something out of it, yeah? But who actually is the one that benefits when we respect our teacher? You know, because the more we respect, the more we make ourselves an open and receptive vessel to receive the teachings. Whereas when our mind's sitting there going, gee, this is a very boring talk. I wish my teacher had, you know, gone to what's that school that teaches you how to give speeches, you know? You know, or, you know, why didn't they take voice lessons or learn how to, you know, do public speaking properly, or, you know, or, gee, you know, they get confused about points. They, you know, they don't tell enough jokes, so I get bored, or, you know, they always are this or that or the other thing, you know. And we find so many things to pick at. But who's the person who loses out when we pick faults with our teacher? Yeah, we're the one who loses out, because then when we listen to the teachings, we don't listen very attentively. We have all sorts of doubt and skepticism, you know. When we have respect for our teacher and respect for the teachings, then we value the opportunity. But similarly, too, with the teachings, if we don't respect the teachings, then it's kind of like, who are listening to this talk anyway? You know, there's such a good TV program on. Yeah, I want to go home and watch that. Or, you know, there's so many other things. I really need to do my laundry. Yeah? And just think, you know, instead of going to this all this, you know, this retreat over the weekend, I could stay home, I could do the laundry, I could clean my house, I could, you know, balance my checkbook, all these things that I've been wanting to get done, I can just stay home and do them all, and then, you know, and not go to the teaching. And that's the conclusion you arrive at when there's a lack of respect for the Dharma. Yeah? Because, you know, that's not going to bring me so much happiness by Sunday night. But having all these little chores done, oh, then I feel like my plate's really clear. I feel so good. We tell ourselves these stories, don't we? Yeah?
Why do they say to live a moderate distance?
Why did they say? Okay. Sometimes. They say that if you have a very uncontrolled mind, it's better to live a moderate distance from your teacher, because when you live with somebody all the time, then automatically the mind starts picking faults. It doesn't matter who it is. You know, even the Buddha moved in with you. We would start picking faults. You know, he's radiating too much light and he's not asleep like that. You know? And he cares for all these sentient beings and they're calling the house and I want to be left alone. You know? So, you know, whoever we live with, our mind will find faults. So if we have a very uncontrolled mind, they say that, you know, keep a little bit of distance so that you protect your own mind from becoming a nam-tok factory, you know, in relationship to your teacher. Yeah. But it also can become an incredibly good learning experience, too. So when you live with your teacher, you're there all day and you know, things get pointed out to you and you have the opportunity to really see how your teacher handles all these different circumstances. So you get an idea of what it looks like to apply the practice to daily life situations. You know, you get a whole bunch of teachings that you're never going to get if you just show up one night a week for teachings.
Well, yeah. Have you said
a
number of times. I think I was kind of a
devotional. You said once that
something about people that rely on devotion after about 3 or 4 years sometimes.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Okay. So then, yeah, I have
my calendar ticks by.
So when you feel like you're a person of devotion and then you remember me saying that people of devotion sometimes fizzle after a while, I think it depends on the level of devotion that you have. Some people have more or less devotion and it depends upon the kind of devotion, you know, that one has. Because some devotion you have because of having knowledge and having wisdom, so that gives you confidence and faith because you've seen the qualities of the Dharma, you've seen the qualities of the teacher, so that enhances your faith. Okay, that kind of faith and devotion is quite good, okay, because it's based on some kind of investigation. When we have the kind of faith of, oh, such a holy teacher, and he looked at me, you know, and you see, I'm dramatizing it, but it abounds, okay? Then after a while, when the teacher doesn't look at you, then you go, oh, I thought this person was so compassionate, you know? So compassionate and so loving, and now they have so many other disciples, you know, that they're taking care of, and they have no time for me, and they don't look at me anymore, and, you know, they just give me jobs to do, and I don't want to do those jobs. Yeah? And so then, okay. Or, so that kind of devotion, you know, then somebody often fizzles. Or if somebody has the kind of devotion, like you hear a certain teaching and you just say, oh yeah, you know, yeah, Buddha said that, I believe, makes sense, fine, but you don't analyze. Then, you know, somebody else comes along and says, you know, gives you a whole different religious philosophy or theology. And because you haven't examined, then you go, oh, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, maybe there is a cosmic mind and a primal substance and God created the world. And yeah, that kind of makes sense. And then your faith kind of shifts to something else because your faith hasn't been based on actual understanding. Okay? I usually make that comment because, you know, about faith because at the beginning, I used to criticize myself a lot and say, oh, everybody else has so much faith in the teachers, you know? And they're kind of, I would see these Westerners and they're all, you know? And kind of, and just so much faith in the teachers and faith in Mo's, you know? They all want to have these divinations done. They have faith in Mo's and, you know, and they have so much faith in pujas and faith in blessed pills and all this kind of stuff, and I'm just like, that just doesn't do it for me. And I would, you know, and I go, oh, children, you know, you don't have any faith in, you know, here are all these people, they just seem so happy and full of faith, and you know, you're sitting there saying, how do you know that enlightenment is possible? How do you know that Buddha exists? You know, I mean, I went through years, you know, I remember a whole retreat. How do I know Buddha exists? Why am I following this practice anyway? You know, how do I know enlightenment's possible? How do I know there's Dharma? How do I know there's Sangha, you know? And just all these kinds of questions coming up. And then I'm looking at all the other people who just, oh, you know, and, you know, I'm just really kind of, you know, just full of too many questions and too many doubts. And I just criticized myself. And then it took me many years, like maybe 20, you know, to realize that after 20 years, I was still there, you know, with all my questions and all my doubts. Maybe slightly fewer questions or deeper levels of doubts or something. But a lot of the people who had been so in love with the teachers and everything at the beginning, you don't see anymore. Okay. So that kind of woke me up. Like, oh, well, don't criticize yourself because you don't know. You know, you don't know in the long term.
Do you think because we really thought about that a lot? You know,
like,
in
mind
that's possible
or
not,
is
possible.
And
when people would criticize you for choosing the life that you
did,
you were more firm.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. Because you're asking if I think that because I thought about those things a lot, then when people criticize me for the life that I chose, that I was more firm and confident. Definitely. Mm-hmm. Definitely. Because if I hadn't thought of all those things, then all the arguments that people gave me about why I shouldn't be ordained, they would have made sense to me. Because from a worldly perspective, oh, if you ordain, you know, I mean, my grandma said, if you ordain, then what's going to happen when you're old? You're not going to have a husband, you're not going to have kids. You know, who's going to take care of you when you're old? You know, and my parents said, you know, you got this whole college education, and, you know, what are you doing with it? It's just a waste. And I remember one time when I went to buy cloth for robes in India, the guy who owned the store said, but you're so pretty, you know. You don't. You shouldn't kind of deny this. It was the only time everybody said I was pretty. But, you know, so, you know, if you don't think well about why you're following the path and what the benefits are, you know, and what your long-term goals are and what happens at death time and after death and what really is happiness, if you don't think about those things, then all these things that other people say, they make sense. You know? And it's like, oh yeah, you know, gee, I better go out and earn some money, otherwise I'm going to be old and I'm not going to have any money, I'm going to be a bag lady out on the street, you know, in Newport, and I'm freezing cold, and, you know, nobody will love me, or, you know, I'll be an old person, they'll stick me in an old age home, and, you know, stick tubes in me, and that'll be it, and so, you know, I really need to have some money, and, you know, husband wouldn't be bad, and can take care of me when I'm old, and some kids, you know, and people say kids bring you so much happiness. And, you know, kind of then I have something to leave to, that's my mark that I existed on this planet because I have kids, you know. I was because there's somebody with my genes carrying on, you know, or somebody with my name carrying on, or somebody that I imbued with all these good values who I'm going to make do whatever I wanted to do but couldn't do. I'm going to make them do it whether they think that's happiness or not. Yeah. So, yeah, but when you really think about, you know, what is the mind? And does it cease at the time of death? Yeah. And what is the body? And what's the relationship between the body and mind? What happens when you die? And what really is happiness? All these people that you see around you that are so busy doing so many things, are they really happy? Yeah. And what is human potential? Is human potential the greatest use of your human potential to become a CEO of a Fortune 500 company? You know? Is that the use of human potential, to be able to make bigger and better widgets and bigger and better bombs? You know? What really is the meaning of my life? Yeah? And when you think about those things, you know, and then you explore kind of the Four Noble Truths, and you think about them, you realize, wow, Four Noble Truths are really true. Buddha knew what he was talking about. And this isn't just kind of a nice fairy tale that you tell yourself sometimes when you're feeling a little spiritually down. This is like serious business, because if I don't practice, you know, death could be at any time. And am I really prepared to die? And what kind of karma am I created? And where am I going to be reborn? And if I'm reborn, you know, in a lower realm, what in the world am I going to do? You know, if I have a lower rebirth, what in the world am I going to do? Yeah? Yeah? You can't do anything, you know. Forget about benefiting sentient beings. You can't even help yourself in a lower rebirth. Yeah? So you realize, you know, this is serious stuff. So then if people talk to you and they say, oh, why don't you get a life and get a boyfriend and, you know, blah, 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 you just like, you know, it just doesn't mean anything to you. Yeah, because you see that they're looking at it 100% from the viewpoint of this life is all there is, and happiness is what you get through your senses. And that's the limit of their worldview. Yeah? And so then when they say all these things, you know, you see why they're saying it, you understand what their worldview is, and you're very clear about how you don't have that worldview. Yeah? And so then they say that, and you say, oh, thank you very much, and you just go on living the way you're living, saying, how did I ever get to be so fortunate that I have the clarity of mind to be able to see the Dharma as true. Because how many people come to Dharma teachings and they don't have the clarity of mind to see the Dharma as true? You know? Or they see it's true, but they kind of don't have the inner strength to kind of, you know, get into the practice. And so then, you know, you look, how did I ever get so lucky? This is unbelievable. But I have this opportunity. That I'm not just sitting next to mind who's sleeping on the sofa all day.
I would imagine that you've run across some kind of weird circumstances of being in your role and like some strange circumstances once in a while, or no?
So have I run into some weird circumstances? Sure. Yeah. Life is full of, well, life is one weird circumstance. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're ordained or not ordained, you run into weird circumstances, don't you?
Yeah.
You know? People get married and divorced, and then, you know, when they're getting divorced, they're going, how in the world was it that I married this person? You know, what was I thinking when I married them? Well, you're obviously thinking something. And from the viewpoint of who you were then, you saw things entirely different than from the viewpoint of who you are now looking back on it. Yeah? So yeah, everybody encounters a bit of circumstances. That's nothing new. Yeah? And everybody encounters somewhere where you go where, you know, you don't fit in, people look at you weird. Yeah? I mean, if you ever travel outside this country, even as a layperson, you know, you go to India, you know, people who've never seen white people look at you. What in the world is that? You know? Yeah? So, yeah.
Not that much. I guess I mean, Buddhism, I've studied Buddhism. I've met a couple of people that have been weird. Some of the things that they talk about, I just think,
Okay. So now you're talking about people who are Tibetan Buddhists who say really weird things. Yes, there are those. Okay. Yes, some Americans, yep. Because the thing is, you know, in Tibetan society, there's much more social pressure. Yeah. Here, people, you know, sometimes, and you have this in any religion, you know, that people who, you know, see life a little bit differently, they're attracted towards religion, and some of them have this genuine spiritual yearning, and some of them have emotional problems. There was just an article in whatever that magazine is, Time or Newsweek, about some guy in Florida who says he's Christ, yeah, and he's also the Antichrist, and you know, and he completely believes it. Yeah. So any religion you go to, you know, you meet sometimes people who say and believe really weird things. Yeah. So that's nothing new. You can go to law school or study poli-sci, go to the White House. People say some pretty weird things in the White House, don't they? Yeah?
There's no getting away from that.
Yeah? Yeah? Yes, we're going to get the world to love us by dropping more bombs. Yeah, that's a pretty weird way of thinking, I think.
Yeah. Well, I think the part that I think this is all carries is being a spiritual mentor and the projections that get thrown at you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and being the, you know. I'm working really hard on pulling that one. That's the wrong But, you know, how much people, their all their aspirations, what their projections, what their fantasies are about spiritual business.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, they project all that stuff.
You know, and how you can still stay with the compassion of the Bodhicitta when these people are just being unrealistic and provocative and demanding and unrealistic and everything else.
Okay. So when they're projecting stuff onto you as the spiritual protector, sometimes they think you're in a home beyond thou and you know, want stuff from you. Sometimes they're incredibly critical and demanding. But you know, whoever you are in life, whatever you do, people are projecting stuff on you. Yeah? And, you know, so this has its own particular variety of projection. And you just have to learn to, like, let it go. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And, okay, some people overestimate my qualities. Well, if that helps them in the Dharma, that's good, but I know I don't have those qualities. Mm-hmm. Some people pick at me because they want me to have qualities I don't have. What can I do? You know, that's coming from their mind. It's not coming from me. So,
well, part of what I see since I've been here at the Abbey is that as I start to gain the understanding that it's all that's coming from my son, mm-hmm. that really does help when the projections start by anybody. I mean, not just
yeah.
the spiritual teacher, but you know, it's all residents, guests, even teachers, you know, the cleaning, you know, whoever's working on the house, you know. But it mm-hmm. really isn't. It's such a big temptation to just not want to own where our feelings are coming from. You know, where our expectations are coming from and how much we have them mm-hmm. in relationship to everybody. So we really want people to be very much mm-hmm. what we want them to be.
Oh, yeah. We definitely want them to be what we want them to be. At any particular time.
Mm-hmm.
Because what we want somebody else to be changes.
Oh, yeah.
All the time. And they are supposed to be clairvoyant and read our mind so that they know what we want them to be at any particular time and happily comply.
Do you feel isolated sometimes being the only? I mean, you're kind of this main, you're the main teacher, you're the main head nun here.
Yeah, sometimes it's isolating and sometimes it's not. I mean, that's why I go to these monastic conferences and mm-hmm. why sometimes I'll talk on the phone with some of the other monastics
yeah.
here and there and keep in touch with them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then hopefully, as time goes on, we'll have more monastics. Yeah. And you just get used to it after a while. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, I'm not perfect in all their eyes again today. Oh, next day, oh, I'm still not perfect in them. But next day, oh, they're still not happy with me.
No, actually, I think it's the middle of the park, and I've actually had a few little jokes going because we've been here at the Abbey, we've actually seen a few of our own little projections thrown at us from people who come to visit.
Oh, yeah.
You know, what a full-time resident at the type of quality the world is supposed to be on the path at any given moment is quite incredible.
Yeah.
We are.
Yeah.
And it's really been quite eye-opening.
Okay, let's quiet loose.